one more time. Welcome, everyone. I'm going to open the hearing of the House Transportation and Economic Development Committee this Monday, April 13th, 2015. We are doing a little bit of paperwork here, so if you'd indulge us just for a moment, Patrick and I will make sure we have everything lined up that we need lined up here, because there's quite a bit of paper to shuffle today.
I got to check in on a committee that I'm going to testify.
And I believe that Representative Hack will be in around 3:30 or so. She notified us that she is testifying in another committee today. You're going to see, as you all know, a lot of moving back and forth. It's a busy time in the building, and people are committed to other testimony at times. So please forgive us for that.
So my suggestion was to work, just work. Everything we're carrying over. That's all I put on the ones we're carrying over. Yes. Two on the front and one on the back page.
Let's just, okay, we'll just do those all first.
And we're going to hear this one, but we have not yet received the paper. Oh, we have. That's the one I'd start with. We have seven people signed up on
this one. Okay. Just begin there.
Ooh.
So we'll go one, two, five, six, seven. Do those, okay? Okay. Thank you. We're going to change the order a little bit today, and we will be opening a hearing, a public hearing on House Bill 2283 first. I'm sorry. Back up. House Bill 2464, the Connect Oregon Bill. We have a number of people here to testify on that. Then we'll move to 2283. So opening a hearing on House Bill 2464. Mr. Brennan, give us a little tee up here, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2464 authorizes issuance of lottery bonds for transportation projects funded through the Multimodal Transportation Fund during the 2015-17 biennium. It specifies allocations of lottery bond proceeds by region, declares emergency effective upon passage. This measure comes to us with a blanks in the amount of lottery bonds, Madam Chair, but this is essentially Connect Oregon 6 is what we have before us. It does have subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We have no amendments before us, and I have not yet received the fiscal impact statement to the measure, Madam Chair.
All right, Mr. Brennan, thank you. We have a number of people signed up. I would like to call up first Chris Cummings. And I'm trying to call people who are Martin Callery. Should we just do the 100 miles first? And good. Jenna Marmon, please.
Yeah,
we have some people who've traveled quite some distance, so we'll begin with you three. Thank you for joining us this afternoon, and in whatever order you choose. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Chris Cummings. I'm the Freight Program Manager for ODOT. Connect Oregon 6, or Connect Oregon Program, resides within the Freight Planning Unit at ODOT. This bill, as mentioned, puts aside an undetermined amount for Connect Oregon 6. It's essentially Connect Oregon 6. The governor's budget has $58.6 million for Connect Oregon 6, if you will. Connect Oregon is a lottery bond-backed initiative for multimodal projects in the areas of aviation, marine, transit, rail, and bicycle and pedestrian. Bicycle and pedestrian mode was added as part of Connect Oregon 5. Some other facts about Connect Oregon is that 10%, as was mentioned, needs to go to each region within the state, each Connect Oregon region. There are five of those. They're similar to ODOT regions. Grant recipients are required to match 20% of the program cost. Loan recipients are eligible for 100% of program cost. Also, Connect Oregon is specifically not eligible. Projects that are funded with highway tax dollars or highway motor fuel dollars are not eligible for Connect Oregon funds. So streets and sidewalks and such are not eligible. Only those modes I had mentioned. Since its inception in 2005, there's been five rounds approved of Connect Oregon for a total of $382 million. 240 projects were awarded for Connect Oregon, with a total match for those 240 projects of around $600 million. So the $600 million in Connect Oregon funds equal about $1 billion that we're approaching in infrastructure investment, non-highway infrastructure investment in Oregon. What's notable, too, about those grants that were awarded is approximately 280 applications were not awarded for $600 million in requests. Connect Oregon has a multi-pronged review process. It's sort of a bottom-up review process, whereas applicants on their own submit applications to us. We have staff that review the applications and against legislative considerations that we're given. We have over 200 stakeholders in 12 committees that review the applications in their field of expertise, whether it's regional committees, five committees for that across the state, or modal committees for the modes mentioned, plus the Oregon Freight Advisory Committee. Projects are then recommended for funding to our Oregon Transportation Commission. The commission holds a public hearing, of course, before projects are selected. All the committees and the process is quite transparent in that all committees are open to the public. All staff reviews and committee reviews are posted on our website for review by the public. The Connect Oregon, if approved for Connect Oregon 6, we've seen valuable benefits, from economic benefits to businesses in Oregon. Connect Oregon provides access to freight mobility. It provides access to jobs from a perspective of transit and bike ped projects. It also improves efficiency of the system, improves utilization of the system. ODOT supports this bill. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jenna Stanky-Marmon. I'm happy to be back here to give my support for this bill, for House Bill 2464. I'm chair of the Oregon Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee, and in that role sat on the final review committee. I work for Jackson County in Southern Oregon, and in that role I was an applicant in the process as well. So as Chris mentioned, BikePed fits this category well because there's lots of multi-use trails that don't fall within the road right-of-way, so this provides a funding opportunity for those kinds of trails as well as bike share. I just wanted to highlight some of the points about BikePed and its role within Connect Oregon. So this last round, Connect 5, there were $6.2 million of funds that were allocated to four projects for BikePed of the $44 million total in Connect Oregon 5. There's a real strong local demand for BikePed projects. There were a lot of very high-quality projects. And I'd like to just talk briefly about four of the projects that fell right below the funded line. The City of Tigard Trail proposed a trail that wasn't funded that included $5.2 million in local investment as part of the project. The City of Redmond proposed a project that parallels Highway 97, provides a multi-use option to Highway 97, which, as you know, is a pretty big barrier for people in Redmond. It's a critical element to their transportation system plan, which provides routes for people, the 60% of the people out there who are interested in biking but concerned about sharing the road with traffic. The City of Brookings proposed a little trail project between Harris Beach State Park, which has 1.3 million visitors annually, in hopes of attracting some of those visitors to walk or bike into town and spend some money in the City of Brookings. And then lastly, the City of Garibaldi proposed a project that would be the kickoff project to the Salmonberry Corridor, which has huge, strong local support as well as state support, elected and local jurisdiction support. So these were projects that were just below the funded line for Connect Oregon, and these are a good example of the kinds of caliber of the projects that we're seeing in Connect Oregon for the BikePed program. They provide critical connections. They break down the barriers for people to access employment centers, shopping, and medical services, and they're critical elements of our transportation system. So I highly encourage you to support this bill and support this program because it's really a great improvement and a great program for our state. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. I know it's a ways, So I appreciate you taking the time to come up. It's not going to be going home. I'm sorry. Mr. Callery, welcome.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, I'm Martin Callery, Chief Commercial Officer for the Oregon International Port of Coos Bay. And in my written testimony, I've submitted information about the success of the Coos Bay Rail Link, which has had significant support from both the legislature and from the Connect Oregon program. So I'm not going to go into those details, but I do want to stress the fact that Connect Oregon is valuable for the state's economy in that it provides opportunities for new connectivity, multimodal connectivity, for many businesses and industry in Oregon. And I will bring up the Coos Bay Rail Link again, because without rail service, we didn't have any other options. We were captive to one mode. But now that we have two modes down there, and actually three modes when you look at marine, that has benefited industry in our area. And that's the type of thing that the Connect Oregon projects do. They give opportunity to new businesses and existing businesses to have the connections they need to compete in the marketplace. And we are a trade dependent state. I think we're all aware of that. I want to see Connect Oregon go forward. I've had the opportunity to serve on final review committee, marine review committee, area commissions on transportation. And I can tell you that these projects get vetted and get asked very hard questions at every step. And it's not a point of somebody kind of hedging over in the corner and saying, well, my project's better and you better do this. It's a open conversation. The public is there to listen, and if they have comments, I'm sure that they add them at the final review committee hearing at the OTC. There is one thing I do want to stress, and I think the bike ped program, the transit program, was a good addition, but it has caused some controversy. I want to see a Connect Oregon People and a Connect Oregon Freight with separate funding so that we don't have the conflicts we've had before. I think there are a lot of good bike ped projects. You've heard about four that didn't get funded that, you know, should be funded at some point. But at the same time, sometimes bike ped and some of these freight mobility things just don't compete well in the same arena. So I think it's important that we move forward, but I would like to stress that I think we need to reevaluate how the program is set up and look at a way to fund both categories without robbing from one or the other. And I'll be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Representative McLean.
With the last comment that you just made, so it's just a blanket criteria, so it's the best projects, period.
Madam Chair, Representative, it is. We do have considerations given to us by the legislature, but it's the best projects by consensus of all the projects submitted. Yes.
Okay. And your website will tell me all of that. As far as you said, you had a site that I could go to.
Representative, yes, we do have a history of each program on the site, and we have the applications, the award winners up on the site, and a matrix that explains how, it gives an order of the projects as they were selected.
Okay, thanks.
Great, thank you. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the comment about having two separate ones, I think we have a real tough time finding enough funding to satisfy everybody. Would you recommend, with the funds that we have, splitting it in two and having half go to freight and half go to people? Or because I don't think we're going to find more. That's sadly the problem. So could you comment on that?
Chair McEwen, Representative Gorsuch, even in a perfect world, yeah, I would ask for $100 million, but I also understand the realities of the budgeting process, and a lot of people are here in the building at different times during the session asking for money for very valuable projects, education, healthcare, social services, and those are all important. But at the same time, I think we do have to pay attention to what drives Oregon's economy. splitting it 50-50 may be the best process. But at the same time, I think there needs to be some kind of an analysis that says, okay, these are how these projects benefit the state, whether it's the tourism sector for BikePed, whether it's transit that connects people to jobs, or whether it's the freight mobility aspects that make sure that we have those jobs. As I say, I'd like to see $100 million. I'd love to see $200 million and split it right down the middle. I know that's not going to happen, but I think we need to focus on how these two programs, both integrated and separately reviewed, can go forward.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here this afternoon. We have next on our list, Jody Weiser and Mark Landauer, please. Thank you for joining us this afternoon, in whatever order you choose. Ms. Weiser.
Okay. For the record, I'm Jody Weiser, testifying for Tax Fairness Oregon. So we have been following the Connect Oregon process for the last two rounds, and we've become pretty concerned about the program. I'm going to give you three examples from the last funding cycle to show what our concern is. Basically, when the bill was written, it was written as a loan or grant program. But the definition of the program didn't really say anything about when you would give a loan and when you would give a grant. And so most recently we've passed out $47 million and $2,000 of it was given as a loan. And a number of the projects that we look at, it's like, I don't think that we would make this investment if we were looking at it and juxtaposing it to some of the other investments we've made. Though the project is good and you can see how it'll do something for the economy, but why wasn't it a loan rather than a grant? And the way the program is structured, it is the applicant that decides whether it'll be a loan or a grant. There's no place else where a different decision has been made. So I want to review three of the things that were most recently funded. Teven Brothers had already received $6.7 million of Connect Oregon funding in rounds 1, 3, and 4 when they applied for funds again this year. The funding this time was to add land and more rail spurs. This is a thriving port. It's a thriving, privately owned fort with plenty of customers. So why is it that we now have given over $9 million to this private port? They undoubtedly had the assets and the customer base to get a loan either from banks or to qualify for a loan from us for the kind of expansion they're doing. But they asked for a grant, and so they got a grant. One of the one commenter when they were reviewing, the review process is amazing, but it's broad rather than deep. So one commenter noted in reviewing the round 4 application, the applicant could finance the improvements with private funds, which would be repaid with fees. That's kind of what we see too, but there is no movement to say, so this should be a loan rather than a grant. Located adjacent to the Teven Brothers port is South Brothers, and they just received $1.1 million of Connect 5 funding. It'll pay for two new cargo hauling machines, rolling stock. Well, we've heard in several different meetings concern from the people who now have funded this, have now, you know, sent to the Oregon Transportation Commission this on a list of things to be approved. We should maybe not be funding rolling stock because it could be sold the next day. It could be moved to a port in another state. And again, why aren't the customers who are using that machinery paying the fees that would pay for the machinery they need? It's great that we're helping a private business, but do we have money to do that when we're not funding so many of the other things that we're concerned about? And the third example I want to bring up is the Sisters Airport. The Sisters Airport is 22 miles from two other fully adequate public airports that Connect Oregon has been funding. It was a private airport. It is still a private airport. The current owner of it bought it for $900,000. And since then, we have invested. Yes, that would be quite an airport.
Oh, really?
That might get PDX or something. They bought it for $900,000, and they've put their business there, and some other business development has happened. And that's wonderful. But those businesses could be 22 miles away at one of those other airports. There's space. There's industrial space at those airports. Or they could be driving 22 miles to the airport. We can't afford a fully functioning airport every 22 miles in the state. There's just no way we can afford that. And yet we are doing this. We're continuing to add to infrastructure when there are actually fewer people flying and private planes. And we're not looking at, does this make sense in the way that it seems like we should? Because the people who are sitting around the table making the Connect Oregon decisions aren't juxtaposing them against the other ways we use our state's resources. And so we would suggest that this bill needs an amendment that encourages a portion of the funds to be used as loans and a portion to be used as grants, and for Chris Cummings and his staff to be involved in the decision making about which applicants should be able to use the funds from fees for services to repay the loans that are granted to them. Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Weiser. Mr. Landauer.
Well, good afternoon, Chair McEwen, members of the committee. I'm Mark Landauer here on behalf of the Oregon Public Ports Association this afternoon. Our membership is diverse, both in size and geography. Our members stretch from the southern coast, Brookings Harbor, down just north of the California border, north to Astoria, and then 190 river miles east along the Columbia River to the port of Umatilla. Together, Oregon's public ports employ directly, indirectly, and induce over 101,000 jobs in the state of Oregon, generating nearly $600 million in annual state and local taxes. And the Oregon Public Ports Association would like to express its very strong support for moving House Bill 2464 along in the process. Connect Oregon has become a national model for public-private partnership and has proven to be an innovative infrastructure investment program for the state. It has helped to ensure that public fund investments leverage private sector participation and results in overall benefits to Oregon's multimodal transportation system and the state's critical traded sector economy. Transportation infrastructure is not cheap. Bottom line, it is not cheap. Resurfacing an airport, putting in a rail spur, assisting in a port facility, it's not cheap. There are a lot of permits, a lot of infrastructure, so on and so forth. This measure has been a critical funding mechanism for our state's ports. It is one of the very few state programs that has been able to assist ports in meeting the demands not only of their communities, but also of their employers and ultimately their employees. Generating 1,000 jobs in Portland oftentimes can be a front page news item. In the Port of Bandon, generating 5 jobs is a front page news item. So proportionality is important to keep in mind here. In the last five Connect programs since 2005, well over 200 projects have been funded. Nearly $382 million of public resources has been expended, while that money has leveraged a great deal more from the private sector. As a result, we would support the continuance of this program. $58 million is certainly a generous sum. We would certainly like to see more. And I just remind the committee that all of these projects are rigorously reviewed by modal committees, regional committees, and then, of course, at the state level. And so with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for you. Do you know, over the life of all of the various Connects, how much percentage-wise has been expended via loans versus grants? I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
So I think it's like, Chris would probably be better at this, but probably $12 million or less has gone out as loans, mostly early in the program.
And is that correct, $382 million over the life of Connect? Is that correct?
That's the approximate amount that was generated in order to issue funding for projects. Okay. There was additional funding, I believe, made available in order to service that debt.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gorsuch. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much for being here this afternoon. We have two more people signed up to testify. Mr. Dedelius, did I get that correctly? Am I close? All right. And Mr. Langner. Thank you, gentlemen, for appearing before us today. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Thank you. Please go ahead, Paul. Thank you, sir. I'm Paul Langer. I'm with Teven Brothers Land and Timber Company, also a member of OLRUL, and testifying here on both OLRUL and ourselves. We're in support of House Bill 2464, Connect Oregon. At the nadir of our recent economic downturn, it was Connect Oregon that created 70 new jobs in rural Oregon County with unemployment over 11%. It's in that investment in transportation infrastructure brought this kind of economic improvement in rural Oregon. Time and time again across the state, Connect Oregon projects have really been have created the intermodal connections, have created and maintained jobs, and increased the local tax base. I dare say Connect Oregon in my region, and this is up in Northwest Oregon, did more to stimulate the economy than many other stimulus projects. It's exceeding your expectations. This wise body, when you created Connect Oregon, didn't understand what a powerful tool you gave the state and every and all the regional intermodal connections. It is fabulous. Our project, we created 70 jobs in a little place called Rainier, Oregon, but 67 different Oregon firms had a chance to go out and continue and grow their own business. Window makers in Klamath Falls, people out of Ontario, Pendleton, Hood River, Redmond, Bend, Brookings, Coquille, Roseburg, Eugene, Crabtree, Tillamook, Lebanon, Astoria, McMinnville, Salem, and Portland Metro. They have jobs because we're there to provide a conduit to get Oregon commodities that can go offshore to Hawaii or go coastwise to California. Now, there's some people that are critical and said this, some of these projects haven't been totally researched and they may not understand all of Connect Oregon. I've had the benefit and the pleasure to sit on both the rail and marine modal committees. We do understand. We do ask hard questions. We do ask, what does your timeline look like? What does the permitting look like? How do you move forward? We do ask those questions, and we actually bring to the selection process a bunch of, I think, really real-world knowledge, understanding that if it's a marine project, you're looking at 3 or 4 or 5 years just to get your permits in hand. There has been some criticism of grants to loans. The problem that we find with loans, and that's why there's only been one, my understanding, since Connect Oregon 1, there's been one loan. It's been for about $2 million. The biggest problem is under GAAP, those loans show as a liability to the company. And we have to carry them on our books until that liability is exhausted. We understand that. In our Connect Oregon 3 project, we added laydown acreage that created the 70 jobs. We knew there was a need out there, but we couldn't get, it wasn't a bankable project. It's really difficult to get loans right now. Even as the economy improves, the banks are not lending, and they want to have a rock-solid project that goes forward. We put that project in. It forced us to go spend $3.5 million of our own money, which we now could because we could borrow to get that money to buy the equipment that went on the tax rolls. So in our Connect Oregon project, not only did we take a piece of property that to our county was paying $10,000 an acre, that acre went to $150,000 an acre for the assessed value, and then we put $3.5 million of personal property taxes on top of that. It's a pretty good return on investment for Connect Oregon. I also look at the railroad project where they changed a bridge out. Now, when you get a Class 1 railroad, they've got a $6 million or $6 billion capital improvement fund project list, and there are projects on 17 states, but they came to Oregon because there was a Connect Oregon opportunity. And they came there, and there was a bridge grant. They first asked for 80%. They lowered it down. I think they paid for half of the bridge out of themselves. Connect Oregon paid for the other half. But it took a railroad bridge that had a speed restriction to 25 miles an hour, and then brought it back up that the railroad has, for passenger rail, it's now 70 miles an hour. For freight, it's 50 miles an hour. The difference between 3 trains an hour, 7 trains an hour. It's phenomenal. It is a great return on investment. That wouldn't happen if it was a loan, because they were not going to take a loan out to do that project. That project would be percolating down here. Who knows how many years before it got there. Connect Oregon is a fabulous program. It is delivered to all the citizens of the state, a really tremendous investment in infrastructure, and it's making intermodal thrive. It's created new opportunities across the entire state. And restoring Connect Oregon to its original funding level of $100 million, if possible, would bring even more success stories. Connect Oregon's not broken. It doesn't need fixing. It just needs funding. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir, for being here. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rob DeDilius. I'm here on behalf of Lake Railway in Lakeview, Oregon, and also I'm president of the Oregon Rail Users League, ORUL. ORUL supports HB 2464 and the Connect Oregon program. Lake Railway has been a participant in Connect Oregon twice. It's been a huge success. It's been a great source of economic development, both in southeastern Oregon and I think the state in general. Lake County is a very geographically isolated part of Oregon. I think Lake County has right now the second highest unemployment rate. It's a challenging place to do business. We do have some private industry left there. We have a mill in the town of Lakeview specifically. We have a lumber mill and we have a perlite mine. Both of these shippers, these rail shippers, are completely dependent on rail as their only cost-effective means of transportation to reach the rest of the state and the U.S. economy. These industries are actually growing very slowly, but they are growing, and rail service is critical. If they lost rail service, you just can't get trucks into that region. They can't find a backhaul, and it's just too far. So we've specifically used the Connect Oregon funding to help us rebuild this publicly owned 100-year-old railroad. It needs a lot more work, but we've definitely made great strides. We're well on the way to making it a modern piece of infrastructure. And again, publicly owned. Right now, there's still upgrades needed in rail size, also to the bridges incrementally. There's a lot of there's many years of deferred maintenance that we still need to get to. But the Connect Oregon program is working. With the Connect Oregon funds, we've been able to establish consistent service. And not only are our existing shippers growing, but for the first time, you're seeing new companies come to Lake County. We have a new mill opening up there shortly, later this year. We also have Red Rock Biofuels is going to start a biomass refinery, and they will be making jet fuel for the Department of Defense and airlines, et cetera, out of wood chips. And both of these companies will ship primarily via rail. So without the Connect Oregon funding, they wouldn't have come. I would add that the Connect Oregon funding, even on Lake Railway, supports the entire state. We buy rail, other track material, other supplies from all over the state. Most of this material comes from the Willamette Valley. And, of course, we spend a lot of money on salaries in Lake County. I'm very happy to say that this program has just been a huge success, and we can't urge you any more than to keep its funding and to expand it.
Right.
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious. So you said it's publicly owned. Obviously, when it was built, it was private. So does the county own the railroad, or who owns the railroad?
That's correct. It's owned by Lake County. We're the contract operator.
Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both very much for your testimony. Paul, could you speak to what you think the multiplier effects might be? So we've invested a certain amount of public dollars in these projects, but in each instance there's some sort of match or either additional public money coming in or additional private money coming in. In your experience, what do you see in that regard?
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, you know, that's for the real smart minds to figure that one out. But I can tell you, let's look at one segment of a Connect Oregon 4 project. We added 17 jobs. It was the investment. We had a 70% 30%, or we matched 30% to 70%. It took, at the time, we were moving 2 million board feet of lumber, just kind of the stuff that came out of the corners of the warehouse or Santa Ana mill, to California. It wasn't even a guaranteed volume. It would come in sometimes. Weyerhaeuser has stepped it up. They have now guaranteed it. We move 13.5 million board feet every 3 weeks. It's a full shift, 5 days a week at the Weyerhaeuser mill to produce that. It ends up then going on to 70 rail cars, which is two full switching crews that come back to bring it up Portland. It starts with the Albany and Eastern, hands off, comes up on the Portland and Western to us, where we have 17 jobs we've created. But then it goes on to the longshore shifts. Here's, you have organized labor loading that barge, and they're out there. They now average one full shift a week. We have basically have eight guys every day have a job all the time because of this operation. And that's what we say. I can't put dollars and figures around it. I know that, you know, the cost to us is about $100 an hour for a longshoreman, mm-hmm. and it's a pretty expensive little shift there. But that's the number of people and the impact across the region. When you take a look at the other projects that go out to, let's say, Geldwin down in Kay Falls, there's a bunch there that, again, you can't get trucks in and out, or the trucks don't get a backhaul, but all of a sudden they now can hit this market. It may not be a full shift, but there's a handful of jobs there.
Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question for you. I have a district that's quite varied when it comes to poverty. And the west side of my district is extremely poor. And I know that this question will come up from my voters, which would be, why are we funding a program like this when we can't fully fund education? And so how would you respond to that question?
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, that's a tough one because it's very emotional. But in my county, we export children. Our biggest export of our county is we're sending our kids out of there because there's no jobs, there's no opportunities. Maybe it's not a pure one-for-one match on how we're going to get this dollar return, but take a look at when a piece of property goes on the tax rolls, it was paying, I mean, we had 30 acres, $10,000 an acre, it's paying probably about $3,600 a year in property taxes. All of a sudden, you got 30 acres and $150,000 an acre. The school is the biggest beneficiary, and that's where that investment comes back in there. It works out. The other one is there's now jobs in the community. People can come back in, you know. And good Lord willing, one day there'll be enough jobs that my daughters can come home and live in the community they want to live in, instead of having to go to the big city.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Borsak. Gentlemen, I thank you both for being here. People might be surprised how many 100-year-old publicly owned rail lines there are in Oregon. There are more than one I might make note of. And I clearly understand how difficult it is to find funds to do rehabilitation and maintenance on lines that have been neglected for some time. So your information does not fall on deaf ears here. I just wanted to make note of that, and I'd be proud of the work that you've done down there in helping to provide some economic recovery for your region of the state. It's very important.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And, sir, I recognized every location you mentioned except Crabtree. Where's Crabtree?
It's a suburb of Lebanon.
Okay, thank you. I got them all. I got them all but that one. That one I was not sure of. It must be a stop on the rail line. Is it?
Indeed it is, Madam
Chair. All right, thank you.
In fact, we're actually on Avon, Oregon, a suburb of Rainier.
Must be like Canary. Thank you very much for your testimony, gentlemen. I appreciate you being here today. Mr. Brennan has just informed me that we have not received the fiscal on this bill yet, so we will be carrying House Bill 2464 over to Wednesday, sir. Would that work? So this one is going to be carried over. I would just like to make note now that for many varied reasons, we will be carrying over today House Bill 2283, 2237, 2459, 2621, and 2995, and to wrap up, 3005, House Bill 3005 are all going to be carried over today.
Till Wednesday.
And that brings us to, and I will close the hearing on House Bill 2464, and I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2734. And I believe we have a dash two amendment, and I would like to call up for House Bill 2734. Let's see, it's David, is it Rubino? Thank you. I knew I was not going to get that right. Sure, if you don't mind bringing up an extra chair, we'll just call all four of you. Okay. Mr. Rubino, Mr. Tucker, Mr. McCourt, and Mr. Ashton.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'll just get started.
Thank you,
I'm
Mr.
Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, and I just wanted to refresh your memories a little bit. Actually, on this bill, you have not seen it, but we did appear before you on House Bill 2289, which is also on today's agenda for a work session. We are speaking as members of the Oregon Brownfields Coalition, which has come together over the last couple of years, over the last year and a quarter, I guess, to really elevate the effort to address funding and policy needs for brownfield cleanup in Oregon. We distributed, I believe, this one-pager at the last meeting, which includes all the names of the members of the coalition. The bill before you today, this bill, 2734, began in the House Rural Communities Land Use and Water, and is there something else in the name of that committee? had a full hearing there with a lot of testimony, and because of the time crunch and the point of the session we're in, we have not recruited a parade of testifiers today, but we do want to talk to you about the amendments that we have before you. So what we're going to do, there are two main elements of this bill. It creates two authority for local governments to do two things: to create land banks to facilitate brownfield cleanup and redevelopment, and to offer a tax abatement, again, to facilitate brownfield cleanup. And so my colleagues, actually, I'm going to step aside for a minute and let David Rubino and David Ashton speak to the land bank element, and then Doug McCourt and I will speak to the tax abatement element, if that's okay, and just
Thank
kind
you.
Of describe what these amendments do.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is David Rubino. I'm an attorney at Tonkin Torp in Portland. I'm also a member of the Brownfield Coalition that Mr. Tucker just spoke about. I'm not here representing any particular client. I've been an environmental practitioner for over 25 years, about half of that with the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and the other half being in private practice. So I have had an extensive amount of experience in dealing with the problems associated with brownfields in both urban and some rural areas. The purpose of the land bank portion of the bill is to provide local control to local government entities to work with and try and move environmentally impaired properties back into productive use. Many of these properties sit either vacant or idle. Some are behind in their property taxes, but they are an eyesore within the neighborhood, and they also impede other development. So the purpose of the land bank is to address one of the main concerns that a city has, which is if they were to acquire the property unnarrowly, they could be walking into a liability problem, which is, as an owner of property, they could assume the liability for doing that. This bill tries to address some of those problems by giving the local government the authority to establish a land bank. It's a decision by the local government. It doesn't have to be done, but if they elect to do it, they can do it. It then creates an independent legal entity, separate and apart from the city, that would be authorized to do anything they would need to accomplish their purpose. They can acquire property through gift, they can purchase it, they can issue debt, they can take on debt, anything that would be needed to accomplish the purpose without exposing the city itself to any independent liability for those actions. They could be sued and be sued. They can hold the property. They can dispose of the property. They can lease the property. And they can also set priorities for the development of the property. So if they believe that certain properties are better for industrial use, they can set that as a development goal as they look to try and find a developer. If they'd like mixed use or residential or open space, they can set these priorities as well. As I noted, the authority itself would also not take on any independent liability for any contamination that exists at the time that they acquire the property, which is a departure from existing Oregon law and existing federal law. They would also, if they elected to perform some of the remedial work, they would be authorized to initiate cost recovery actions to get the dollars back that they've otherwise expended. It would provide for transparency. Their meetings would be public meetings. Their decisions would be listed in the minute books, which are public documents. They would prepare annual reports, which would be available to the public. And the board itself would be comprised of not just members of the municipal government and the school board, but also representatives of local citizens organizations as well. We believe that this is a positive step forward and can hopefully provide one of the tools that will be needed to allow for both urban and rural communities to bring back into productive use these types of brownfield properties. With that, I'm going to turn to my colleague David Ashton from the Port of Portland, who can give you a little more detail on some of the key aspects of this bill.
Thank you, sir. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is David Ashton. I'm Assistant General Counsel with the Port of Portland, based at Portland International Airport. I've been practicing in the area of environmental and natural resources law for 24 years and for almost 15 years with the Port of Portland dealing with those issues. Brownfields redevelopment is a really important aspect of the port's missions, and the port's very pleased to be part of the statewide coalition on brownfields redevelopment. We think this bill contains some very important additional tools in the toolbox for brownfields redevelopment, and I'd like to emphasize four of those tools, if I could, please. One of them is that it's very important to protect the local authorities' general fund from liability associated with the acquisition of these properties. Currently, under the law, if the Port of Portland acquires a piece of contaminated property, then if something goes wrong with regard to that acquisition, there is the potential that we will have long-term liabilities associated with the contamination on the property. The ability to create these land bank authorities enables the creation of an independent authority to hold, clean up, do habitat restoration and redevelop these particular properties. It makes it very clear that the authority is separate and apart from the local government that sets it up, that launches it, if you like, such that no one can accuse the authority of being the alter ego or merely the agent of the local government that sets it up. That protection for the general fund of the local governments combined with the immunity from cleanup liability created for the authority itself is a very important tool. Relating to the immunity of the authority for the contamination liability, this bill actually simplifies the environmental due diligence process associated with the acquisition of these tools. Instead of going through a fairly complicated and therefore somewhat costly process of negotiating a settlement with the state and then meeting the separate federal requirements for acquisition, the parties involved in acquiring these contaminated properties can rely upon the immunity of the authority and simply use the due diligence that they need to avoid liability under federal law to meet the future legal requirements associated with continuing to avoid picking up the liability associated with historical contamination on the property under state law. So it's beneficial in terms of streamlining the acquisition process. Thirdly, the governance structure for the authority, consisting of a board of directors involving representatives of the community and the advisory committee component of the authority, provides an important mechanisms for facilitating stakeholders coming together on what the redevelopment should look like to create the optimal balance of industrial, commercial, residential, open source, or natural habitat restoration uses. And so that facilitated stakeholder participation in the creating the future for the brownfield site, I think, is an important process and part of the process to overcome some of the challenges associated with the development of these sites. And then finally, I wanted to mention that an important component in this bill is to create for the authority a cost recovery mechanism, a clear cost recovery mechanism where if the authority undertakes cleanup or habitat restoration associated with the resolution of natural resource damages and is able to find the responsible polluter or the insurance behind the responsible polluter, it has a very clear remedy in order to recover those cleanup restoration costs from the polluting party. And that makes it very clear that that remedy is available for the authority. And that, of course, is very consistent with the principle of polluter pays, which is embedded in Oregon law. At this point, I will turn over the microphone to my colleague, Doug McCourt.
Chairman Kuhn, Vice Chair Davis, representatives, members of the committee and staff, good afternoon. My name is Douglas McCourt. I'm a partner with the law firm of Vader Wynn in Portland. I live in inner northeast Portland, where many of these brownfields are located. It seems like we all must have graduated law school about the same time, because I put about 25 years into it. So I guess if you combine Randy's and all of our years of experience, we're about as old as one of these publicly owned railroads in the state of Oregon. My comments are going to focus very briefly and primarily on the financial aspects of House Bill 2734, and I'm here, of course, to testify in support of it. There's really two places I want to call your attention, and these are in the dash two amendments that you have in front of you. One is in section 5, and again, building upon the testimony of David Ashton and David Rubino, in addition to trying to make it very clear this is a distinct entity from the local government that established it, you know, not too dissimilar from a public corporation, we did clarify one key element from the original bill, and that is that notwithstanding that distinction, that the local government can either use its funding authority, its debt authority, to issue debt, including bonds, on behalf of the land bank, or by resolution or ordinance can deem the land bank's authority essentially to apply to both the general credit or the tax revenues in issuance of debt by the land bank. And that is a key difference from the original bill. And the main reason for that is that we need to provide a financial tool that investors actually want, and without the backing, with the full faith and credit of the local government and the, you know, backing of the tax revenues, the people are walking away from these properties as it is. They're not going to buy a bond that doesn't have that kind of backing. So that is a critical change. The next area of changes are in sections 12 through 15, and we've worked very hard to craft a property tax abatement structure, not only with our broad coalition, but in particular with members, Special Districts Council, Association of Oregon Counties, a variety of entities, including the representatives of the Oregon State Property Tax Assessors Groups. And what you have in front of you, I'll just hit a few highlights of those amendments. So we have the local government that elects to grant the abatement essentially in charge of the entire property tax abatement process. They notify the local property tax assessor that they're going to do this, and in order essentially to move forward with the abatement, instead of this opt-in, opt-out kind of process that we had at the beginning, we now have a procedure where the local government will obtain at least 75% of consent from all of the taxing levies and the authorities in that local jurisdiction. And if that minimum 75% is reached, then the local government will essentially adopt the property tax abatement ordinance, and it can apply up to 100% of that property tax abatement. And it's a program that will go on for 5 years and has a number of provisions, including a clawback provision in the event that any of the information turns out to be incorrect or false. And it has, similar to what you've seen in other bills, a number of additional bonuses for the creation of low-income housing, for the creation of permanent public parks and open space, for improvements that generate renewable energy, for projects that hire at least 50% of the remedial action work performed by minority or women business enterprises or disadvantaged business enterprises, a bonus that creates permanent jobs, or creates hospitals or healthcare facilities in areas designated as having unmet healthcare needs. So I will stop there, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have on the structure. But once again, I would emphasize that we've come a long way in working with the assessors groups to really understand how their existing property assessment and property valuation process needs to work. We've added, working with Ledge Council, a structure for actually using the valuation methodology that the assessors apply, so that we're not creating a new wheel here, and it's something that they're used to and have tested in the past. With that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Lively. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Could I just clarify also, these amendments, we got them at about 1:35 this afternoon. So you got them, I sent them to Patrick, I don't know, around 2 or so when I saw them. So we're still working our way through them and making sure that they're what we requested. They look close, you know, and but just wanted to put that on the record so that you understand that we're still kind of scrambling ourselves and trying to make sure that they're right. And I already have a note in case we need to modify them a little bit before you move them forward. And I also want to make it clear that I got into law school but decided not to go over 25 years ago. So, it's, you know, it took a while, but it worked out okay, I think. So
duly noted, Mr.
Maybe it worked out well for the law. Anyway, so happy to answer any questions. I'm sorry.
Ms. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm having a little hard time sorting out protection of general funds and committing general funds for protection of bonds. And so early on you talked about this be set up so it's a separate entity that would control the property net. So in that sense, the general funds of a government are protected. But yet then later in this amendment I was reading through about the bonds, and the bonds, if I read this correctly, the bonds would be provided by the local government, may incur debt, including issuing of bonds available to local governments on behalf of the authority. So the local government has to issue the bonds on behalf of the authority that the authority would use. And then the local government's revenues, yes.
Representative Lively and members of the committee. It's a purely local choice. As initially structured, the authority would have the ability to issue bonds or take on debt if it wishes. So let's stick with the bonds. They could issue them. The problem we were running into or was alerted to us is it's a brand new entity. So who's going to want to buy the bond if it doesn't have any backing? There's no track record. So the local government has the option, again, at its discretion, to elect to backstop the bond or to issue its own bonds on behalf of the authority. But again, it's purely a local choice. And it was meant to, as Mr. McCord indicated, try and get some comfort to investors who we would otherwise hope would buy the bond to help facilitate the funding for the authority, which ultimately it's hoped that it's a self-sustaining entity that would be able to buy property, sell property, and continue to move them and finance itself. But it may need some kick-starting, so to speak, at times.
One follow-up. Thank you. So we talk about the ability to abate taxes. Does this authority, with this authority, ultimately have ability to levy taxes?
No.
No.
Not independently. I mean, it was. This is.
No, that's the Chairman Kuhn, Representative Lightly. That is correct. It does not, specifically does not have the authority to levy taxes.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you all very much for your testimony, for being here today. I have two questions. First of all, the model for land banks, maybe you could give some examples of where it's been successful elsewhere in the country. And second, as it relates to the abatement, can you explain, I think we got into some of the technicalities of it, but on a broader level, the amount of the abatement, the certification of costs, et cetera.
Sure. Representative Davis and members of the committee. Land banks have been, in our research, used successfully in the state of New York, in the state of Indiana, in the state of North Carolina, Missouri, I believe in one of the Carolinas, and Michigan. It was used quite actively, particularly in the city of Detroit and Flint and some of the other cities that came out some very hard times and had very, very high tax foreclosure and vacancy rates. So the concept has been out for a while, and it has been successfully used in multiple states. This is fine-tuning a little bit to focus on brownfields per se as opposed to just foreclosed properties. But it's a structure that has been used elsewhere, and our research indicates that it's been a successful structure where it's been implemented.
Else? Representative McLean. I'm sorry.
I had to follow up on the second part of the question.
Please.
Right. Chair McKeown, Representative Davis, Vice Chair. I think your first question was, what are we abating, really? And it's the lesser of the eligible costs or up to 100% of the property tax. And in this area, since eligible costs being defined as essentially cleanup costs, but you have to be in a specific program with the EQ, either an agreement or under an order. In virtually all the cases, the costs are going to way outstrip the property tax. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason we structured it that way.
Thank you.
Yep.
Representative McLean.
I think your last answer, the last sentence almost, helped me a little bit. But the whole idea of doing this is to make sure that you're not having a public entity have their general fund, you know, basically out there, just, you know, really in danger, because they've got a lot of other responsibilities. But what it does allow is more for private development and allows for private cleanup and for a private-public partnership, you know, with the different aspects that you've described today. But it does say right here in the beginning of your House Bill 2734 that the cleanup will be done and that there has to be a DEQ plan to do that cleanup and closing of whatever issues might be on the brownfield. So it's not as if we're not taking away any of the responsibilities. We're reorganizing the responsibilities so that the private industry that would develop will be able to come in and help in that endeavor of taking care of the brownfield issues. Is that sort of common knowledge, not legal language, but just...
Chair McKeown, Representative McLean, I almost don't want to say anything because you just articulated it beautifully. And that's exactly what we're doing.
Okay.
The one point I may not have made, in addition to, you know, this going through a DEQ program, we work very closely with the Department of Environmental Quality to hit this spot that is really the crux of the problem, of really why some of the laws have actually created some of these brownfield problems. in that they create what we refer to as status liability. Merely by virtue of being the owner or leasing a piece of this property, you can be liable for it, even if you had nothing to do with the contamination, nothing to do with the cause. And so what we've done in this bill and the 2289 is we have required that the applicant certify and notarize affidavit or declaration to the department, in this case the local government, that they had no responsibility in causing, contributing to, or exacerbating the contamination. So basically, not only do we achieve the benefits that you described, but we're really getting at those parties that are solely in the chain of liability by virtue of having done nothing but buy the property or lease it.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions for this panel? Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak to this item? Seeing none, gentlemen, thank you. I might offer that we have another bill, 2289, that's on the docket. Would it serve in our best interest just to move into that hearing also? I am assuming you're going to have comments on the same topic. Would that be a reasonable thing, Mr. Tucker?
Yes, Madam Chair. Mr. McCord is prepared to explain the amendments.
Okay.
That's actually scheduled for work session.
Then on that note, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2734, and I will move into a work session on House Bill 2289. Mr. Brennan, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I get started, maybe I should just point out this green sheet that all of you should have in front of you is kind of like the playbook for today's meeting. So 2289 is the last bill on the front half of the page. That page, House Bill 2289, we heard on the 16th of February, so it's been a while. It creates tax credit for cleanup of brownfield property. It's applicable tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2016. Since we met last time, we now have a dash 3 amendment, which I believe our witnesses will testify to. That essentially rewrites the entire measure, so perhaps I should turn it over to them. I can let you know that with the dash 3 amendment, because this measure has subsequent reform of the Committee on Revenue, we have received a fiscal light statement and a revenue light statement, so the committee, should desire to do so, has everything it needs to move the bill around.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen?
Well, I was just going to say, Madam Chair, Randy Tucker, Metro. I was just going to say what Patrick just said, which is we're just asking you to move it down to Revenue Committee so we can continue the conversation about in the context of the larger tax credit conversation. But I'll let Doug explain that.
Thank you.
Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Davis, representatives, members of the committee and staff, Doug McCourt with the Portland law firm of Ader Wynn, here in support of House Bill 2289 and, in particular, dash 3 amendments. So this has changed significantly since you initially saw it, and what I will do or attempt to do is walk you through the highlights of the amendments. Before I begin with that, let me just touch on a couple of bigger picture issues that relate to the whole, to tax credits generally. In this coalition, in this very broad coalition that you've heard on testify in other matters, we understood that we were going to have somewhat of a steep hill to climb in this body with a tax credit, but our research nationwide showed that this particular tool, the tax credit, the income tax credit, is one of the most significant tools to be able to attract development and attract financing to properties where it simply is not being met. And that was really probably the first guiding principle of our coalition in selecting this as one of our key policy matters, and that is that it would have to essentially be something that isn't being met by any state program or any federal program, that we structure the credit in such a way that it really does require significant skin in the game by the parties that own the property and all of the participants in the transaction, and that includes both the cleanup and the redevelopment of the site. And another principle that we tried to have guide us through this is that it dovetails, and this is bears on some of the amendments that I'll describe, that it dovetails as much as possible with existing state programs. It works in compatibility with Business Oregon's brownfield programs, with DEQ's programs. It requires a minimal amount of effort, and again, this is a change from your first draft till today, from the Department of Environmental Quality. so that we're not stressing their budgets out when they're not getting any revenues from this. But we are, we do have safeguards and fail-safe mechanisms in the bill so that if there are issues and there are questions that come up, or they're, you know, we've used, we have the ability to check in with DEQ. We use terms in the amendments that are defined terms under existing cleanup law, or as we define affordable housing and those kind of concepts that are well known in the state. So let me first describe what the amendments actually say about the credit itself. This is a credit against 50% of eligible costs, and they're cleanup costs, and we define that in a particular way, removal or remedial action as defined under state law. The eligible cost in order to even get a dollar under this tax credit must exceed 25% of the assessed value of the property. So right there, we're building in a mechanism that requires you that this is, you know, starting to get to those properties that are the market isn't going to touch, that they're partially underwater, and thus the need for an additional incentive. The total credit per taxpayer per year is capped at $500,000. The total value proposed in the program on an annual basis is $10 million. Any unused portion of a credit that exceeds the cap can be carried forward for a period of 5 years, and we provided a five-year total program cap so that you, if you have eligible costs in one calendar year, working with the assessors group, they had us make sure the application goes in by March 15th on this, in a specific way. And if the next year occurs that you have eligible costs, it's a whole new application separate from the carryover. And the credits are transferable. And that's a key component here because of some of the difficulties that we've all talked about in both the getting to cleanup and getting to the compliance with DEQ rules on the cleanup, but then convincing somebody to invest in the property and actually redevelop it. Similar to some of the bonuses that we heard before in the land bank bill and the property tax abatement, we are adding specific bonus activities to increase the credit above the 50% limit. Remember, it's 50% of your eligible costs. And those bonuses include cleanup of sites in areas of extreme poverty, construction of affordable housing, creation of permanently protected open space, construction of hospitals and healthcare facilities in designated areas of unmet healthcare needs, creation of at least 5 permanent jobs that pay at either the state or county average in commercial or industrial areas. So that's a quick flyover of what the actual credit is. A few other notes on the amendments. As I mentioned, we added a number of terms to make sure that when we blend both income tax and cleanup, we're using both the programs that exist with the Department of Revenue as well as DEQ and the terms that they define under state law. We have clarified the eligibility requirements, and again, it requires that a taxpayer submit a notarized affidavit or declaration to the Department of Revenue that they may have status liability by virtue of the fact they own or operate the property, but they can't have caused, contributed to, or exacerbated the contamination. And we also added to the eligibility requirement that they be under an order or in an agreement with the EQ and that they be in compliance with that agreement. Lastly, for a transparency and accountability provision, which was very central to a lot of members of our coalition, the work that the taxpayer essentially has to do first is to do a property environmental site assessment. And they can be eligible for the tax credit just based on that assessment if the assessment shows that no further remediation is necessary. And what we have learned in all of our, you know, getting gray hair and doing this for a long time is that 50%, maybe more, of the properties that people think are seriously contaminated, once you actually study what's there, you learn that either it's nowhere near as contaminated as you thought, or you can manage the contamination under the state's risk-based management approach, and you can actually stop at that stage, manage the residual contamination, get the site redeveloped, and move move on. But for those cases that actually require shovels in the ground, actual remediation, then our eligibility requirements require that they conduct that under a DEQ program, that they remain in compliance with it, and then all of the reports that go along with both the assessment and the remediation get filed with DEQ. They become public records. They publish them on their website so that, you know, when the state is granting this valuable incentive, people know what the money was spent for. And I think those are the main highlights. There's a lot more details that I can answer questions about, but I'll stop there and see if we have any.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to clarify when we say tax credit, exactly what I mean. So this is ultimately a credit against any income that the company would have earned. And so if that is the case, and it's they're eligible to carry it over for 5 years. So in theory, if they went the 5 years and didn't have any income to credit to use the credit against, there wouldn't, and then it would just expire at that point.
Chair McEwen, Representative Lively, great question. And correct, but what we did to try to address that problem, first of all, just to clarify, this is a credit against state income taxes.
Right.
And second, we recognize that the work doesn't always start on day one and end on December 31st on year five. It can start and stop and start and stop, and then investment comes in at different times, so that we wanted to make this small going forward, so that's why we picked a period of 5 years. But those 5 years don't have to be consecutive, and the applications don't have to be consecutive either. So we're trying to capture the realities that, you know, people clean up property, then they go market it. Mm-hmm. They don't always have the developer right behind them ready to do the work.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it looks to me like the $10 million would be gone in an instant. Is that a thought?
Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz, that's a distinct possibility. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the right number was, and we sought guidance from revenue. We sought guidance, of course, from practitioners. And again, this was one of the features that we knew we were, you know, any tax credit discussion is going to be an uphill battle, so we wanted to start with a modest program, see how well it works, see how it's used, and if we get the success that other states have that is very remarkable, we can possibly revisit that number at that time.
Follow up.
Yes, sir.
So is there some sort of a lottery thing in here? Mm-hmm. I mean, how there should be a line out the door for this type of hand, literally. So what's the mechanism for getting to the front of the line, I guess is the way to put it?
Well, there isn't really a mechanism to get to the front of the line, but what we did in part is, and this was a subject that came up in significant discussion in the coalition, is we limited the credit to a single taxpayer can get up to the cap, and then they're done for the year. So you can't have a situation where you get only the wealthy construction companies and the wealthy developers starting to hog all the credits, basically. This is a first-come, first-serve type of program, and there's not a way for somebody to basically, you know, push their way to the front of the line.
Last question. The 50%, did it come from someplace? Because the 50% of eligible costs and then a series of ways of driving it up to $1 million. That's what it looks like to me. So where did the 50% come from? Because it appears to me that you could make it 25% and still have a long line.
Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz, you could have a long line at 25% or something lower. What we did is we looked across the country. We studied at least two dozen of these. And some statutes don't have any percentage. They essentially allow, you know, they don't cut it at the beginning. Some have lower. I mean, one had 75. You know, what we tried to do was take a really good read of the landscape out there across the country and find something somewhat in the middle.
I lied. I have one more question.
You may, sir. Thank you.
So I was looking at the additional things that people can do to drive up the credit, and being from a rural area, it appears to me that a number of them would never apply to rural areas. This would only apply to cities that have a need for the type of housing, for example, that's on this list. What did you put in this to make sure this was as balanced as possible when it comes to rural and urban?
Well, Chair McEwen and Representative Bentz, we got a lot of feedback from both representatives of rural and urban areas on these, and these, for example, the healthcare needs. We looked at examples from places like Astoria or Eastern Oregon, where, you know, what we're seeing in the market is a kind of something very different than the typical big old hospital that used to be built in the central community, but a more dispersed type of healthcare in rural areas. And so every one of these, I mean, you've got poverty in rural areas, you've got unmet health care needs, you need affordable housing. You need, we hope, to be able to mix up the blend of who actually gets the jobs between disadvantaged business enterprise, women business enterprise, minority business enterprises. And we hope that every rural area that has some potential for commercial or industrial development can also take advantage of the jobs. Now, the jobs is an area, I admit, Representative Bentz, that, you know, we heard some feedback in particular from the League of Cities representatives, Association of Oregon Counties, that one job would be manna, right? We have a requirement in here that we have a bonus for five jobs. I would say that's probably one that I would agree does tend to look more urban than rural, and I think we might be well served to do something similar that we did in 2734, which just make it any job that you create. I mean, we heard about that, you know, from the police departments, from, you know, the various types of rural jobs, and that one job can make a big difference. So, but I think you'll find that all these other factors are, we got feedback from rural and urban areas.
Madam Chair, may I also respond to Representative Bentz? I think, you know, this is the first time we've brought this legislation forward in the legislature, and we are looking for feedback like what you're providing right now and want to continue the conversation. You obviously will see this again, I hope, down in, well, I shouldn't say obviously. Don't want to assume anything here. I hope you will see this again down in the Revenue Committee possibly in the Joint Committee on Tax Credits, and I would look forward to continuing the conversation about how to make this the best mechanism it can be that is the most efficient with the state's resources while also providing an incentive that will actually get properties cleaned up. So,
any other questions for this panel? I had one question, and I don't want to belabor it because we are running short on time and we have some more bills to hear, but I heard you say extreme poverty. How are you defining extreme poverty?
So the term that we've added is, and I'll just read it, completion of a removal or remedial action at a brownfield property located in a census tract where at least 20% of the residents are below the federal poverty line is determined under 42 U.S.C. 9902 in effect on December 31st, 2014. So that would
depend on the entity and what geographic region it covers. It's not a blanket for a county. How would that work?
It's a census tract. Yeah, so, right. So, yes, it's not going to necessarily follow.
If it's a port district, it would be.
Right.
District. If it's a county, it would be within that county.
Correct.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, right. I mean, what we've heard in unfortunately, what we've seen, and again, I'll use an urban example just because I'm a little more familiar with it personally, is that our census tracts in Portland, unfortunately, over the last decade have grown. We have more census tracts in poverty now than we did 10 years ago, which is unfortunate. And, you know, we'd hold it up to that metric.
Okay. Madam Chair, I want to clarify. A census tract does not mean the size of the jurisdiction. I'm not the expert on what a census tract is, but I don't believe it's what you just said, which is like if it's in a county, then it's the county's poverty rate. If it's in a port district, it's the port district's poverty rate. I don't think that's correct. And I'm going to let somebody else.
We can do that
me.
Offline,
yeah,
Mr.
Exactly.
Tucker.
I'm
curious as to
smaller,
how that works.
It's okay. A much smaller area of land than a county or a port district.
Chair McEwen, I guess I heard your question a little differently. What I heard was that you look at the boundaries of the local jurisdiction. They are what they are. Within that, you may have one or more census tracts.
Right.
They're not going to correspond exactly to those jurisdictional boundaries.
That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. So you could have multiple census tracts, then you would have to do some sort of a calculation.
Well, the property is probably within one or just a couple
of
census tracts.
And correct.
So I think we should take a look at this and see how this actually works. But yes, I think in Portland, I think there are hundreds of census tracts, for instance. Now, I'm way out beyond my expertise.
Again,
on
we can take
tracks.
This offline. We're
yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Yeah.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I will look to the committee. Would you? Shall we go ahead and move this on down? Unless there may be some more work to be done, but I think we ought to move it on down, get out of this committee, and send it down. All right.
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendment to House Bill 2289.
Vice Chair Davis moves that we adopt the -3 amendment to House Bill 2289. Are there any questions, any objections? The amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2289 with the -3 amendment as adopted to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
And Vice Chair Davis moves House Bill 2289 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to revenue. Are there any questions? Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have some serious concerns about the bill. I'll get to see it again since I'm on tax credits and revenue. So I have serious concerns, not because of the need. The need's amazing. The challenge is one of knowing that there are literally thousands of sites to clean up, and that this is a very modest attempt to try to spread that risk. I'm not sure this is the best way to spend our tax credits. There's so many good ways to spend them. And so I'll be looking forward to have that discussion. But I want to make sure the record is clear that I'm joining in the vote to move it there, but there's a lot of heavy lifting to do on this one.
Duly noted, sir. And Representative McLean.
Well, I don't get the advantage of getting to sit on this other committee, so I want you to hear what I have to say today. Is that okay? I really agree with you that there's so many different ways to use tax credits. There's 45 tax credits for individuals alone, and I've just been looking at some of that material. But this is one where I would say we haven't used them before, and I think we need to. And even if it starts out small, and even if it starts out, you know, sort of as a pilot, so to speak, I think that this is one area where we haven't gotten folks to develop those brownfields that we know we need to get developed, because we want to do a good job of using land well, and also we need to have the cleanup done. And so I just hope you'll keep an open mind as you look forward to this discussion in your other committee.
All right. We have a motion on the floor. Any other questions, objections? Call the roll, please, Clerk.
Representative Bentz.
Aye.
Representative Heck.
Aye.
Representative Wiley.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Vice Chair Davis.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Yes.
Chair McKeown.
Aye. Motion carries. Let's see. Let's move to House Bill 2282. And Mr. Brennan, if you would give us a short briefing, please.
The House Bill 2282, we heard this back in March 16th. It's one of our speed bump bills, but during the hearing on March 16th, we heard two different concepts which are embodied in the two amendments that we have. The first one allows the Department of Transportation to receive electronically transmitted documents on a number of issues like titling a transfer or register or transferring registration of vehicle, etc. With the -2 amendment, the measure has no fiscal or revenue impact. We also heard some testimony, which I believe we'll get an additional briefing on from Mr. Dewey and maybe some other folks that are in the -6 amendment. The -6 amendment specifies that auto dealers may charge a purchaser of a vehicle for performing any of the following actions, and then it lists it. Well, I'll let them go ahead and describe those, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr.
And with
Brennan.
That, I should point out, with that, the measure also has no fiscal or revenue impact. So the two different concepts, both of them fit by amendment into the relating clause of the bill. So, and there's no subsequent referral of this measure, so it goes straight to the floor.
Thank you very much. I think, do we have a test?
Oh, no, this is being a work session only. I think Mr. Dewey is prepared to bring up some folks with him. So.
Thank you, Mr. Dewey. Yes, you may.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh,
welcome, gentlemen.
Thank
you for your patience this afternoon. It is a busy time of year for all of us, so thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Mike Dewey on behalf of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Thank you for scheduling a work session. I think it's appropriate for us to have a discussion. Hopefully, we will be brief. It's fairly concise. I did want to say we have some experts here that can speak to the bill also, Mr. Tonkin and Mr. Remensburg, who will Greg will speak after me. Very quickly, though, I did want you to know, and some of you have seen this, in 2013, the association did an economic impact statement. And in that year, the payroll at car dealerships was $627 million. The total expenses in that year for the car dealers in the state of Oregon was $1.26 billion. So you get a sense of how important this industry is to the economy of Oregon and the number of employees that they have. But we had a previous couple franchise bills up on the Senate side. Mr. Tonkin talked about the franchises that they have, and they have over 1,000 employees here in the state of Oregon. So we want to just keep moving in that direction. So what we do is have a bill that deals with an addition as to what a dealer may charge, and the experts will speak to that. A few years back, in concert with the Department of Revenue, the dealers came to the Department of Revenue to try and increase the fee to have a conversation about additional services that they provide customers in terms of when they sell a car, which is important. And we have a very unique statute right now. It basically says that if you use an integrator, you can charge not less than, and if you don't use an integrator, not less than, which is kind of a remarkable statute. And I didn't try and figure out the history of that. I have some ideas, but I didn't want to speculate. But nonetheless, we the association went to DMV, and somebody looked at it and said, well, we can't do what you'd like to do, even though they had gone down this road, and we'll talk about the services in a minute, because ORS 822043 deals with regard to fee for preparation for DMV-related activities. And some of the activities that we discuss in the statute are not DMV-related, albeit they are related to providing a service for selling a car. So what we have in the Dash 6 are two factors. One is when you use an integrator, this would be electronic software, real time. The fee is not more than $150, and if you don't use an integrator, it is $115. And then we put in statute that the fee that would be paid if you use an integrator is $25. We would like to entice the auto dealers to use integrators in the sense that it's real time, and also DMV is working through their modernization program, and it would work in concert with that. So I'm going to stop and let Mr. Remensberger speak to what we're trying to do in this bill and provide a lot more certainty for you, I hope. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee representatives. My name is Greg Remensberger. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, so I'm here today representing the 249 franchised new car dealers and new truck dealers. To give you a little bit of background on this fee, it was established over 30 years ago. It was in the Frohmeyer time frame that they established this fee. And in 1999, it was changed, and that's what Mike was referencing. It's kind of an odd bill. At that point, the legislature wanted to establish that this was a justifiable fee, but wanted to take it out of the legislature every time you wanted to go to increase the fee. So what they did was spell it out that it was for DMV paperwork and titling processing only, and that it had a floor of $50. You couldn't charge any less than $50 for it. And if you were using the electronic integrator, you could charge an additional $25 to do that. Again, there was an incentive from the DMV to try and move that. The cost that was incurred by the dealers to utilize the integrator was a little more than half of that fee, so there was a $10-$11 incentive for them to go that direction. DMV still wants to move that direction, going electronically, eliminate paper, expedite the process. Law enforcement loves it when the vehicle is registered quickly and you get plates on the car immediately and so forth. So that happened back in 1999, and at the time, the legislature empowered the Department of Transportation to establish a governing body and put in administrative rule how the cap of that fee would be set. So DMV was a logical choice because it was DMV paperwork only, and they in turn went and set that fee with a cap of $75 if you were doing the paper version and $100 if you were doing the integrator. Since that time, a lot has changed in our industry. So a few things that the dealers are now required to do, either state or federally, or in effort to try and help the consumers through the process of purchasing and registering a vehicle, include identity theft issues and Privacy Act, red flag rules, compliance, privacy notices, risk based pricing documentation, lien perfection, the Patriot Act, which is a cash reporting rule, just to name a few of them. And in some of these cases, like the risk-based pricing documentation and the red flag rules compliance, we are now required to establish a committee within our own dealerships that monitor how we work on these programs, document every step along the way. We have to have meetings quarterly to review and make sure that we're doing things in compliance and so forth. So these are all things that came into play after the fee was originally established. In 2011, the Oregon Dealer Advisory Council, which is a division of OADA, but also has a stake at the table from everybody who can have a dealer's license and license a vehicle. So it's new car dealers, used car dealers, motorhomes, salvage yards, towing companies, and so forth, all looked at these additional requirements that we had to do, and we're making a pitch to raise that fee to cover these costs that we now are required to do. The ODAC committee approved that and started to go through the process of increasing that fee to the fees that we're requesting today. However, when it went to Treasury to look at it, it was at that point that we realized that the statute referenced DMV paperwork only. So we were unable to do the fee increase at that point, and we were asked to go back to the legislature and expand what that definition was for in order to include and increase the fee. At the same time, it became evident to us that DMV, now that we were including things outside of their normal realm of work, was probably not the best person to be overseeing what this fee would be. So our intent with this bill is to eliminate that silly floor for both of the methods of registering a vehicle, expand the language, but put the cap back into statute. Rather than have to go have DMV regulating it. We talked to the Department of Justice if they would be the appropriate one, and they had too said, no, it really doesn't fall under our bailiwick either. Take it back to statute. So back in 2011 when we were doing this, we did a research study on how much time it takes us to process all of these different aspects, as well as AAA. So an independent body did the same thing, looking at what it takes to process a vehicle, as well as did a report on what the other states charge for these same types of services. And it's ironic how they both turned out, because two different studies. We took title clerks in dealerships and looked at every aspect from the titling side of it, which is already covered by the fee, but the other things that we mentioned in there as well, how much time they did. And then we took the National Auto Dealers survey of compensation for a title clerk and looked at it just specifically for Oregon. So it was not taking California wages or Seattle wages. It was Oregon wages that were used to this, and it calculated out to $162.68 per transaction. The AAA study of what it came to 100, it not only justified those same type of figures, but also looked at what the states that charge a dock fee or have a cap on a dock fee. It came out to a little over $172 for it. So it was somewhat in line with that. There are 32 states that do not charge a or do not have a cap on the fee that they can charge. Most of the states of those 32 states just say, as long as you're consistent and you're charging whatever, one customer has to be the same to every customer that comes in your door. As long as you're consistent with that, you're fine. In Washington, they charge $150. in Idaho, which is one of the non-regulated states. The biggest dealer that most people know from there is Dave Smith, who is out of Kellogg, Idaho. He charges $400 a whack for every one of these that come out of there, yet they love to advertise that they have the cheapest prices on vehicles in there. And what our study has shown when we've looked at this is when you add in that fee based on where our fee is, they're not the cheapest that are in there. Cars are purchased different today than they were in the past. They are researched online intensely before the consumer ever walks into the door of the dealership. As recently as 6 years ago, the average number of dealerships that were visited prior to purchase was over five dealerships before purchase. This last year, in 2014, it was 1.2. dealership visits. They've done their homework. They know what they want. They know what they're going to pay. They know what their trade-in is worth. And either you walk into the dealership and they sell it to you for that, you are able to work the deal together, or you go down to the next dealership because you're not even getting beyond two on the averages from that. Every time I tell that story, somebody says, well, I just bought a car and I went to three dealerships, which just increases the number of people that just go into the first dealership and buy on the spot, working out a deal, you know, there. The competitive disadvantage that we have with surrounding states with the dock fee where we are, we're one of the lowest in the nation. There's only one other state that has a lower dock fee than what we have on ours. So we think, again, with our research and with competitive nature that we, and you look at the things that we perform on behalf of the consumer, which are really a benefit to the consumer. If you look at all of the things that we do on their behalf, they want to pick up their car and go home. They want to just make it as quick and easy as we can, and that's what we're here to provide. And we want to, you know, this, again, allows us to stay competitive in the nature in the surrounding states as well as move forward. Again, I'll conclude with we like to keep commerce moving. And this is just part of the duties that we perform on behalf of the consumers and DMV when we do this type of work. So,
thank you. Sir, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Brad Tonkin from the Ron Tonkin family of dealerships in Portland, Oregon, Wilsonville, Beaverton, the Dalles now. And just as these gentlemen mentioned, doing business today, there's no question that as compared to 10 or 15 years ago, there continues to be more bureaucracy and there's more red tape and there are more duties that we must perform when selling an automobile. An automobile typically is the number one or number two largest purchase that someone makes in their lifetime. It's a collateralized asset. It's an important purchase for people, and we take it very seriously. Our costs to administer the paperwork, not just the DMV, but as Mr. Remensberger referenced, complying with everything else today has changed a lot, as I mentioned, over the last several years. So, therefore, our office staff as well has grown because compliance is not a question. It's not something that we can opt to comply or not to comply with. In order to do good business in this state and be a good corporate citizen of this state, it's what we have to do and what we want to do and what we must do. Our costs have increased, and so we're simply asking that we are able to increase this to the extent that it will help us cover our costs and offset the additional that we have in our employ.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Questions for this panel?
Okay.
Representative Fence.
So I was just looking back at when this last occurred, and I was looking at our administrative rules from 5 years ago. It looked as though they went up from whatever they were, $50 and $75 to $75 and $100. It looks like they were increasing every 5 years. And I was just trying to check to see if the percentage was different in the increase from 2005 to 2010 as opposed to 2010 to 2015. Do you know why the difference in the percentage of increase?
I don't remember the fee going up in 2005. I think the last one that went up before that, and I could be wrong on this, was back in 1999 when we went to $50 and $75.
Madam Chair. And I'm looking at the rule, and it went to $100 and $75. It looks the date of the rule was 11/1 of 2010.
Right.
So what I'm just asking
That's where it is today. The one prior to that, though, I think goes back to 1999. I could be mistaken on that. But that was at the time in 2010 when we did that, we were looking for the increase to go to where we are asking for today. And that's when it was spun out to be strictly on DMV fees. The fee had not increased, again, to my knowledge, I believe it was for a longer period of time than that. And that was escalation in costs and escalation in responsibilities that the dealers were doing. And that was backed by DMV at the time of what it was, and they endorsed the fee increase at that point. But we were not able to get to the level that we're asking for today because of the language that specifically said DMV paperwork and title registration only, and asked us to go back to the legislature and expand that language, which is, again, what we're attempting to do today.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen, for being here this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
What is your pleasure, committee? We have a dash 2. We have a dash 6. We have no fiscal or revenue impact for the measure.
I'm good on the 6.
Vice Chair Davis?
Madam Chair, I move the dash 6 amendment to House Bill 2282.
Vice Chair Davis moves that we adopt the dash 6 amendment to House Bill 2282. Any questions, concerns? The amendment is adopted. Now, we do not have to do the dash 2.
Oh, no, that is, Madam Chair, I should correct. That is incorrect. The dash 2 and the dash 6 are separate concepts. The dash 2 is what we heard at the public hearing. It's electronic signature.
Yeah, so, yeah,
they're
well.
Yeah. Two separate concepts that would both fit into this related
Okay,
clause.
So we need the 2.
We need the 2s.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2282.
Vice Chair Davis moves the dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2282. Questions? Any objections? The amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2282 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Davis has moved House Bill 2282 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any questions? Clerk, will you call the roll?
I do have a comment.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. I just want to note for the record that I am always in support of eliminating a rulemaking and bringing statutory authority back to the legislature, which I'm very glad that this bill does. I think it puts the authority where it belongs, that we so often delegate to our agencies. They do a great job, but especially when it comes to fee setting, I think that's an appropriate role for the legislature.
Thank you, Vice Chair Davis. Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Bentz?
Aye.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
Yes.
Chair McKeown?
Aye. The motion carries. Do we have someone? Would someone like to carry this bill to the floor? Vice Chair Davis will take this bill. Thank you very much. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2282. And we will move along to House Bill 2240. We will open a work session on House Bill 2240. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2240, we heard March 25th that it creates a joint interim legislative committee to review economic development programs in Oregon. I could go on if the committee would prefer. All this stuff that we heard before was on my staff measure summary. I should point out this measure does have subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We have received a fiscal impact statement, which is available on OLIS, and I believe is in your packets. There is no amendment to the measure, Madam Chair.
Okay.
So it will be due pass should the committee take action.
Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Madam Chair, I move the... There we go. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2240 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gorsuch. Vice Chair Gorsuch moves House Bill 2240 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Are there any questions? Clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Representative Bentz?
Aye.
Representative Pack?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
Yes.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Chair McKeown?
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Davis, would you like to carry that also?
Oh, this doesn't need to carry it.
It's going to Ways and Means. Thank you very much.
I will carry it strongly in Ways and Means.
There you go.
All right. Let's see. I believe we are on to House Bill 24. Let's see. Let me close the hearing on House Bill 2240. I'm sorry. It's getting very messy up here. Since we moved around so much. And I will open a work session on House Bill 2465.
Great, Madam Chair. House Bill 2465, we heard way back in February, it eliminates the requirement that driver licenses, driver permits, and identification cards, no changes of address and card. It authorizes ODOTs established by rule, change of address requirements, et cetera, et cetera. I guess I could go on, but I should clarify that we since have received a Dash 2 amendment, which changes some of that. In fact, it restores the language requiring a sticker to show the change of address on cards. Mm-hmm. It removes permissive language with regard to providing proof of address. Adds clarifying language regarding how proof may be provided. Replaces the requirement to proof of enrollment for the proof of enrollment form for school from school with a certification form by a parent or legal guardian, except in cases where the individual is seeking reinstatement for having their license suspended for missing school. So, otherwise, that's the only case in which the school certification form would be required. It could just be by, if a person's applying for a license or a permit, they could just get certification by a parent or guardian. And with the Dash 2 amendment, the measure has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact, Madam Chair.
Trudy, are you clear on this, or would you like ODOT to come up, or are we comfortable with this, with the amendments that are presented? Okay, I think we're good. Representative McLean, did you have a question?
Well, I don't want to make you have to come up. There was only one question that I had that this school. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
If we have a question, I'd like ODOT to come up.
Okay.
I think we need someone on the record to answer the question. And what I might do is ask Vice Chair Gorsuch. Ms. Joyce, do you just mind speaking to the amendment, and then we'll do our official duties up here?
Chair McEwen and members of the committee, I'm Joyce from the Department of Transportation. The amendment does three items. The first is that it restores the requirement that the change of address sticker be on the license. The base bill was going to take that away. Mm-hmm. The amendment restores that. The second thing is that it moves the proof of school enrollment to a parent certification rather than a form from the school. Mm-hmm. As Mr. Brennan indicated, the one difference on that is if the child has already been suspended for having dropped out of school, now they need to bring something from the school proving that they are back in school. And the third item is that it adds some specificity to the types of information that DMV will require for proof of change of address. Those are the three elements in the Dash 2 amendment.
Ms. Joyce, I think you just answered Representative McLean's question. Well, did you have one more question?
One and two is absolutely perfect. I think they did a really good job on the amendment. The third one, as far as specificity to what they can use, you know, to actually verify information. And could you just put on the record what you see that as being and how that happens? You were talking about.
Sure. Chair McEwen and Representative McLean. So in the amendment, it shows up in several different spots within the amendment. Because the current statute addresses it for an ID card, for your first license, for your renewal of the license. But basically, in all those different places, it says that DMV shall require the proof and gives some a non-exclusive list. So it gives some examples, but it's not exclusive. There can be other things as well. So things like a mortgage document or lease agreement, a utility bill, a proof of insurance card, health benefit card, that sort of thing. And then it makes clear, too, one of the things we were trying to get at with the whole bill was getting away from the word document, because Department of Justice had told us that that means a piece of paper. And we're getting away from that in our current world, that it can be something digital. And the other thing, that the reality going forward, is that there are address service, third-party address service companies that DMV may be able to utilize in the future to, again, check up on people's addresses to make sure they're accurate. So getting at all those different abilities by putting some of that specificity back in the statute.
That's what I wanted her to say. I want that on the record because I think that's important. That's a lot of different ways to technically figure that out. So thank you.
Yes, Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say thank you for all your hard work, Amy, and working on these amendments and the good job that you did and all of that. So I just wanted to say thank you for all of that.
Good. Thank you. Thank you for putting that on the record, Representative Hack. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2465.
Vice Chair Davis moves the Dash 2 amendment for House Bill 2465. Any questions? Any objections? The amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2465 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Davis moves House Bill 2465 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions? Clerk, will you call the roll?
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Vice Chair Davis.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Yes.
Chair McKeown.
Aye. The motion carries. Representative Hack, would you like to carry this bill? Okay. Thank you very much. I will tell you, we had a record-setting three bills moved in higher ed this morning in 4 minutes and 26 seconds. So we have 4 minutes to go and two more bills. So let's see if we can... And I will close the work session on House Bill 2465, and I will open a work session on House Bill 2639.
All right, Madam Chair. House Bill 2639 appropriates $2 million for the General Fund of the Department of Transportation for provision of transit passes to secondary school students in lane transit within Lane Transit District. There's no amendments to this bill. We have it does have a subsequent vote of joint ways and means, and so that would be where it goes should the committee move it out of the committee, would be ways and means. We have received a fiscal light statement as a result of that since it will be analyzed down there. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2639 to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Davis moves House Bill 2639 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a referral to Ways and Means by prior reference. Any objections? Clerk, will you call the roll? Oh, Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, I'll be a no on this, and the reason has to do with something that disturbs me about the arrangement on the funding. And I think what bothers me is that if you are fortunate enough to live where there happens to be transit, then we will help pay for it. And if you're not, you're out of luck. Something's wrong with that. And so exactly what's wrong with it? It's not clear to me, but I'll be a no.
Thank you. Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Hack?
I'm a no for now, but I may change my mind.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative
McClain? Aye.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
Excused. He is excused.
Chair McKeown?
Aye. The motion carries. Representative Lively?
It's going to Ways and Means.
I'm sure we will be calling on you at a later date to carry. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2639, and I will open our last work session on House Bill 3401. Mr. Brennan.
Thanks, Madam Chair. House Bill 3401 directs the Department of Transportation to study options for improving on-time performance for passenger trains and freight trains. It sunsets January 2nd. Declares an emergency effective upon passage. We have a Dash 2 amendment, which makes some substantive changes to that. This was slightly different than the amendment that we saw at our previous meeting last week. I believe that those changes are related in the Section 1. They're mostly, if I have that correct, yeah, they're mostly dealing with removing of references to freight trains, Madam Chair. Oh, anyway, with the Dash 2 amendment, the measure has a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 3401.
Vice Chair Davis moves the Dash 2 amendment on House Bill 3401. Questions? Objections? The amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3401 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Davis moves House Bill 3401 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there questions? Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
Excused.
Chair McKeown?
Aye. The motion passes. Yes, and we will ask Representative Nathanson to carry that.
session over in 2734?
We carried it over.
Did we?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I would just, if you would.
On 2734. I don't think we carried that
over.
Did we
carry
that officially, but if you want, you could just do this and say that we're carrying everything over.
Aha.
That's a great.
Well, let me close the work session on House Bill 3401 and make note as a reminder that we are carrying over until Wednesday all bills that were not voted out of committee today. I think we've touched on all of them, but I will make particular note of 2734. All right. And on that note, at 5 o'clock, my apologies for being 15 minutes over today. We are adjourned. 5 o'clock, my apologies for being 15 minutes over today. We are